taping. Today is September 9th, and we're learning Mishlei. We're talking about how Mishlei is used in various commentaries, and we're making the point that you can detect a commentary's background in their parish to Mishlei more so than in their commentary to most other books. It's not based on just the element of the wisdom, literature, nature of it. And when you talk about, let's say, a pasuk that refers to commitments to Rizus, the person will describe events in his own life and events in his surroundings that sometimes you can actually tell very much about the nature of the commentary based on what they read on Mishlei more than other books. So I'm talking now about a type of drash that appears in Chazal, in Gemara's and drashim, called the Psichta, where it says Pasach, a certain rabbi b'haikra, they open up a discussion of the particular issue at hand with a quotation from a pasuk. It's usually way out of left field, usually in Ksuvim. Because Nevi'im, they read on Shabbos, Torah they knew pretty well, right? So they often start off a discussion, let's say, on Megillat Esther, the Yitzhak Mitzrayim story, and they would open up with a pasuk way out in left field from Mishlei Perkov Gimel, and then they would show how that pasuk shed light on Megillat Esther. And I don't believe he means to say that when this pasuk was originally written, they had Megillat Esther in mind, because Mishlei predates Megillat Esther. What they mean is that whatever truth this pasuk is relating can help us understand Megillat Esther and possibly our own situation. Right? This is what we did last class at random, by quoting 6 or 7 psukim and showing how every single one of them. You could do this throughout Sefer Mishlei. So this is what the psichta is. They open up with a pasuk in Mishlei. Mishlei is the most popular psichta sefer, and then they connect that in the end to the issue at hand. Do you notice how this is pretty much the opposite of the way drushas start today? When your rabbi gets up for a drasha, he usually starts with something very familiar. An opening line tends to be in this week's parsha. I know what this week's parsha is, we just read it. And then he takes you into someplace else, a tangential point that this week's parsha touches upon, an event that just took place, a certain mussar I want to teach, you know what I'm saying? So what the psichta does is the opposite. The psichta starts with the unfamiliar, right? Something that people in my audience do not know, it's a pasuk way out of Mishlei, and I'm going to bring it home to something that's familiar. So it's a way of a pedagogical approach that goes from the unfamiliar, and let's work together to bring this to the familiar. The light bulb will go on in the head. Oh yeah, I see where he's going with that. Or to go the opposite, to start with the familiar, and then people have to, and then they don't know where he's going with it. Right? Yes.
Didn't people back then know Torah Shabbos much better than we do, but not necessarily Torah Shabbos?
That's debatable. If they knew Torah Shabbos, they knew the 5 books of Moshe, they were not necessarily so steeped in the Vim Ksuvim. There are debates about this. There's a Tosfos in Bava Metzia, in Bava Basra, the end of Bava Basra, in Berakish in Oakland. The Tosfos admits that the rabbis of the Talmud were not so well steeped in the Vim Ksuvim. There's some places in the Talmud where there are issues at hand. There's a Gemara in Bava Kama, Daf Nun Hei, where a great Gaon, Rabbi Bava Chama, who went over his teachings every month, but he didn't know what was written in one of the Aseres Dibros. He didn't know one of the Aseres. I'll tell you this: Tosfos admits that they just didn't concentrate on the Vim Ksuvim, right? Even though the Gemara says you should learn a third of the day Tanakh, Rabbi Natan in the Tosfos in Sanhedrin edition says that we just have to learn Gemara today. When that started, I don't know. There was a Medrash in Kohelet Rabba that says also you don't have to learn Tanakh anymore. So we know what the situation is today. Just when did it start that way that people no longer knew Tanakh? Was it already in the Talmudic times? Well, later. I'll just close this discussion with an article that Reuven Margolios wrote in a book called HaMikra VaHamesora, where he debunks all of this. He says that the rabbis of the Talmud knew their Tanakh, and these Tosfos and read these things wrong. It's a discussion. All right? But I know today people they know the Nevi'im Ksuvim from whatever Gemaras that might quote them, but they, I don't think they have a Seder in, and it's becoming maybe more popular now. I know the Kollel in my neighborhood just started a whole Tanakh program, an Anach program. So okay, maybe that's good. Okay, let's return now to discuss the introduction of Mishlei. I want to learn the first few psukim of Sefer Mishlei inside with you. What we also like to do is to determine where the introduction of Mishlei actually ends. Okay. Where does the introduction actually end? Okay. This discussion also, what I just gave you out today, this taxonomy of questions, you see it? Right. This is part of a presentation, some breakdown of cognitive thinking that came down. This is back in the 50s and 60s. It's called the taxonomy of questions, the taxonomy of knowledge, that was broken down into six categories. Taxonomy of how we think. And you can see these are not just fancy words, but the point is that these six categories of cognitive thinking can be categorized based on words for knowledge in the beginning of Mishlei as well. We're going to define that. Right? Obviously, the first thing you have to know is information. You probably have been given your whole lives a lot of information that is largely spitback information. Right? They can involve some sophisticated modes of thinking. You know, when was the last time America had three presidents that in a row that filled two terms? Right. So you have to go back and think. You have to know your history. Has it ever happened? The answer is no. But that takes our knowledge. You have to know the history for that, right? Okay, when was... you can answer just things that didn't require quick minds sift through this quickly, and you have your information, yes or no, or what year was the Spanish Inquisition. You know, things that... Some things stick in your mind. Everybody here has a photographic memory. You all know what the quarter looks like. You all know what your house looks like because you see it all the time. Your mind takes a picture of these things, and you're able to bring it up when necessary. You see a picture right now and say, "This is not my house." Right? You have a photographic memory, right? No one calls it that way because you think a photographic memory is that you see something for a moment, your mind takes a photograph, and you can picture it anytime you want. Very few people on planet Earth are able to do that. People say, "Oh yeah, there are lots of people that live in." That's not even with whichever Cam Jansen, there's no such thing. All right? It's a question of your attention. Pay attention to something, the knowledge will stay with you. Problem is that we are always competing. Our information is always competing with other things. Right? So we tend to refer to this as chokhmah. Simplest, you're chokhmah because you pick up a lot of information. This says nothing about your morals, it says nothing about your common sense, it says nothing about your decision making, it says nothing about the application of this chokhmah. You're just able to remember this information and process it very quickly. Right?
Alright,
so we'll get to it. We'll see if Pirkei Avos has a similar... Chesed is written many years later and might use words differently, but the next word that you see on this list is called comprehension, which is often understood as bina. Because to comprehend, you have to be able to lahavin. You have to be able to process something, and what is the shorish of this word now? You see, bain. Bina requires you to differentiate. You getting it? Bina, you have to differentiate between this and that. Between this knowledge, and that is a higher level of cognitive thinking. Right? What's the difference between the way the Chacham asks his question and the way the Rosh asks his question? Right? The knowledge question is, what's the Chacham's question? Okay? Or what parsha does the Chacham's question appear in? Bina question might be, what is the difference between these two psukim? Right? Now, to take it to the next level, which is application, that might explain why the Haggadah treats them so differently. Or maybe an application question would be, the Chacham's question is in Sefer Devarim, the Rosh's question is in Sefer Shmos. There's something about the difference between the way those two Sfarim treat Zechiras Yetzias Mitzrayim that might explain why the questions appear in different ways. I mean, but you see, you're applying information and you're taking it higher steps. Teachers who ask those kind of questions, and they can be asked already in third grade, fourth grade, right? Of course, you have to have simple knowledge. You can't answer that last question unless you know the difference between Shmos and Tvarim. Unless you've been taught some of that, and then you can apply it. You with me? Okay. Now, you know, we can just mince words. I mean, we'll see at the beginning of the Mishnah, there are a lot of different words. There's Seichel, Haskel, Da'as, Bina, Chochma, right? There's Teshura. There are all kinds of words that are used in Mishlei to define what we might call, smarts, right? Just like English has produced different words for these things, right? Okay.
How would you say application theory?
So apply this comprehension, this understanding of the difference between one thing and another, right? To apply, so I would like to suggest the word das right now. What's interesting is that the word das is translated by Tarum Ungulus in the Torah as Mada.
Which is
Mada. Have you heard the objection to the creed of this school as Torah or Mada? Right? Because Torah should subsume everything. You mean Torah or anything? Well, there's a yeshiva called Torah Das. Das is the same word as Mada. How do you usually translate Mada? Is it science, right? Right. What the science wants you to do, it wants you to make an application of this information that's before you. Obviously, you have to comprehend what are these things that are in the test tube, and how am I applying this? Right. I'm just going to stop with these three. We're going to cover the last three next time, because the beginning of Mishlei just really covers the beginning, the first three. Okay. Because analysis, synthesis, and evaluation, can you figure it out? One of those is much higher levels of cognitive thinking are asking you to make predictions. You get it? The three lower levels are asking you to apply what is before you. You know what I'm saying? Apply what is before you. Okay, and because Mishlei is such an idealistic book. We discussed that also, right? Remember? Idealism versus the pessimism of Koheles. A proverb must be very idealistic in nature. Pretty clearly, right? So because Mishlei is so idealistic, right? We pretty much feel that we can predict what will happen if you take this behavior. And that's what the other three are about. And we're going to have to learn more psukim before we can go to analysis, synthesis, and evaluation. Evaluation means, okay, what do you have before you? Evaluate what is likely to happen, or what you feel will predict what will happen based on the information you picked up. Okay, that's the highest level of cognitive thinking. That's what you get Nobel Prizes for. All right? Or you know what I'm saying? You write papers, you write... And you make make studies over science awards for those things, okay? By making appropriate predictions, and then it is proven in the court of experience. Okay, you all with me so far? Okay, we also have discussed a number of different usages of the word Mishlei. I'm not sure reviewing now, but on the first page of your Choveret, I gave you the Brown, Driver, and Briggs. This page here, right? Okay, see it? This is all the various usages of the word Mishlei in Tanakh. Okay, in your introduction of the Da'at Mikra to Sefer Mishlei, he goes through them. Da'at Mikra, don't think he used this too much. This is written in 1905. It gives all the various cognates and usages of the word in Tanakh, but also how it is represented in other Semitic languages, other ancient languages. Right? Okay. All right. And all the usages in Tanakh appear somewhere in this book.
Right?
All the usages of the word Mishlei, like it says in Sefer Yirmiyahu, you will be a mushal and a shnina to the people of the world who look at you. What does that mean? Because they say, see what happens when you don't listen to God. That's what happens to them. You'll be a mushal and a shnina. This week's parsha has the word. Okay?
So what?
It means you'll be a proverb. Really? The Jews are a proverb? What is a proverb? It means that the proverb means like a metaphor. That's what happens when people don't listen to God. So that's why God refers to our suffering as a mushal. You think of a mushal, it's just a proverb. The book is called Proverbs. It's not called mockery for not listening to God. But the word is used in other ways. Okay? In Parshas Balak, it says, Vayisom Mishalo. Bilam picked up the burden of his prophecy. Okay, it's clearly the most common usage of the word is a pitgam. It means a proverb. But the other usages of the word will help us shed light. It's called a ne'um nevu'i from Bilam, right? Okay. The word is used also, not necessarily, in Nevuah. When David, in Perek Ayin Ches in Tehillim, refers to what happened in Yetzias Mitzrayim, and in the years hence, he says, let this be a mashal for the Jews in history. So, Chever, what do all these usages of mashal have in common?
Same.
Yeah, but what they all have in common, they help you with what this book wants to show you, is that Chachma is not limited to acquiring information and processing it. Right? I can use Forrest Gump. Stupid is as stupid does. Chachma has to do with what you actually do. Right? Follow what I'm saying? Chachma has to stand the test of what you do. Right? Okay? You talk about publicly to the whole country about a threat to the whole nation, and then immediately you go to play golf and you're pictured laughing and enjoying yourself, and then you go on television and you say that was a bad optic. What difference does it make whether anyone took a picture of you or not? It was not smart to go from one to the other. Right? It's not a question of chachma. You could have an IQ of 400. Mishlei would teach you not to do that. Not a question of chokhmah. It didn't matter whether anyone took a picture or knew that he went to golf. You talking about?
Yeah.
So just that Mishlei wants to teach you that chokhmah is not simply a collection of data and applying and synthesizing and making analysis and predictions, etc. It's more than that. Okay, you with me? Okay, so that is the point of this book. So I submit to you is that to apply chachma. It's a big chiddush in Tanakh. To apply chachma to morality. Chachma must turn you to morality. And that's where Pirkei Avos comes in. Can you hear me feel it? What's Pirkei Avos doing? Pirkei Avos is nothing but a commentary to Mishlei. Can you feel it? Can you explain that? Can you write a paragraph on that? That's where Pirkei Avos comes in. It's to teach you that in Ein Torah, Ein Chochma. In Ein Chochma, Ein Torah. Okay. But you need to just to be brilliant and pick up and process information is not enough. You remember the Unabomber? Remember that guy?
The modern person.
He had an IQ of like 200, but he lived out in the forest, and he used his tremendous know-how to create bombs, to letter bombs, to mail out to different places, and he killed, maimed many people. I mean, what insanity! Hashem gave you such a gift. How did you use it this way?
Right?
So Mishlei wants to tell the very what I'm submitting to you now, and that's why I'm putting it all together now. Let's learn a few first few psukim. Is that from the various usages of Mishlei in Tanakh, and its usages as Brown Driver and Briggs? We did this in the very first class. Shows you how it's used in Tanakh. We say that the Mishlei is not simply a proverb. It's not simply a pitgam, even a pitgam nivui. It is an example. It is something you use to indicate that your wisdom is making you turn to moral decisions. Moral decisions. Okay, you all with me? Okay, with that in mind, let us now turn to so far we did Chachma, Bina, and Das, right? The three lower levels of cognitive activity. Okay, later on we'll talk about the three higher levels. Right? And if you know, this is a pasuk in Mishlei, but also in Tehillim, Reishis Chochma Yiras Hashem. You see the morality, Yiras Hashem is morality. And I must tell you, I'm just bragging, but this is our religion. Because in other religions in the ancient Near East, all the way up to Roman times, it's only Christianity and Islam that got with this program that I'm about to tell you, is that religion was divorced from morality. There was no morality in religion. Prove it to me. The gods they were worshipping themselves were not moral. Look at the descriptions they give of their gods. The chief god of Canaan was called Baal Hamod because he was the highest ideal of Canaan is to covet something and get it, take it. You with me? When Ahav wanted a vineyard of one of his subjects, you know the story? The Malachim Aleph? He was married to a Tzidonite, a Canaanite woman. And when the subject refused to give it to him, right, so he was depressed. So when he told his wife, she said, I'll get it for you. She got witnesses to claim that the man cursed Hashem and the king. They stoned him to death. And she said, Ale Reish, go ahead, it's yours. Next day, she got the vineyard for him. She was just behaving like a good Canaanite. All right, but that took down his kingdom. Not all of his other trespasses. That took down his kingdom. Because Avodah Zarah is not necessarily immoral in itself, unless it drives you to immoral things. But this took down his kingdom. Not all is Avodah Zarah. You know the story in Melech HaMalef, right? Perek Yutes. Eliyahu is the one who comes to rebuke him for. Alright? So in the ancient world, why do you worship your God? For moral guidance? Come on. What do you worship for? What? Strength, security. Make my crops grow, right? I'll strengthen you with what my high priest tells me you like and what you need, and you strengthen me. Right? There's no morality in it. So comes Yiras Chochma, Yiras Hashem, that this book is here to teach us, right, this element of morality. Right? When Benjamin Disraeli, who at the time he said this was already converted to Christianity, that he was the Prime Minister of England, when Benjamin Disraeli, who still maintained some tendency of pro-Jewish behavior, but he was already a Christian at the time, he couldn't have risen to become Prime Minister as a Jew. But when he was accused of behaving like a Jew, right? Remember, he famously told his accusers in England in the Parliament, when your ancestors were still swinging from trees, my ancestors were writing the Bible and building the temple in Jerusalem. So he means to say that the greatest accomplishment of the Jewish people is this element of morality. And really, historically, all those nations died away because there is no lasting people if you're not moral. It's an amazing message of Mishle and Jewish survival. Right? The two in any religion that has stood the test of time is only a religion that has morality at its core. Right? Islam for a long, long time had morality at its core. I think that this is being hijacked by so many people now, but a religion that does not have morality in its core is not going to last. And not because just the forces of good are more powerful. Usually not. Right? It's not going to happen by itself. But because the forces of good have to raise arms and fight those forces. It's not going to happen by itself. Anyway, let's learn, please, what's interesting, I just want to say one last thing, is that we have recently uncovered similar works from ancient Egypt. Ancient Egypt, advice of parents for their youth. Similar proverbs, but it's limited to advice of parents for their children, how to grow to be productive and have zrizus and not be lazy. And a lot of parallels with Mishle. On that score. A similar time period of Shlomo. Okay. Right. And one of the most important elements of our book is also Musar to chinuch of children. Very important. You can't just start at 20 years old and tell people what to do, how to do the right thing. 3 might be too late. They have to be trained in the right things right away. Because just as Chazal tell us in the first day of their existence, Adam and Chava violated God's word and ate from a tree, they shouldn't have. We are, and you know, depending on how you remember, but you'll be parents soon, Yemirtz Hashem. You'll see that at the earliest age where kids can tell the difference between yes and no, they are testing you. A child learns very quickly, before they can learn to speak, you ever read anthropologists of why it's almost universal that this is no? Go to the furthest reaches in the Amazon, and this means no there. Why? You don't want something, you do this. Right? So children know this very on. They come now, it's time to go. He's 18 months old, and they're crying, and they don't want to go. And they learn to be rebellious. Because it's in our nature. Ki yetzer lev ha'adam ra min ha'urav, it says in Parshas Noach. Right? Why did God create us that way? Can you figure it out? First of all, what's this? So I heard an anthropologist say that when a child is nursing and they don't want to nurse anymore, that's what they do against them.
You're feeding them, they turn away.
Right. They turn away, so that becomes, I don't want anymore. Child, no, you know, no, 6 months, 9 months, they know I'm not, I don't want anymore. So that goes on when they're 12 months, 18 months, 20 months, so that becomes no. And not every place has this as yes. They don't have a yes like that, but this is always no. Anyway, the child learns no very early on. I don't want to continue doing this, right? And children will cry, and they're not old enough to tell you why they're crying. I'm hot, I'm cold, I'm sweating, I'm wet, I have a dirty diaper, I'm hungry, I'm cold, right? They'll tell you it's too loud here, and they don't even tell you. That's not good behavior. That's not good behavior if you're 20, but it's acceptable if you're 8 months old, right? So they keep crying and crying, and they will, for the rest of their lives, cry when they don't get what they want until someone starts to tell them when they're old enough to start to understand and process words, some earlier than others, right? That's not good behavior. Tell me what you want. You with me? Right? You're old enough to tell me what you want now. And then it starts to, you see, it starts to change. Don't cry. But kids will always press the envelope. Right? Rebellion is in our system. Good parents and good teachers have to teach, you know, how using various rewards, punishments. That's why the Gemara warns us: don't reward and punishment unless and punish unless you're, you know, don't threaten a punishment or a promise or reward unless you're going to come through. Otherwise, they learn very quickly. You give them chinuch right away about we talked about limdu l'shonam davar sheker last time. Right? You're teaching your children, giving them chinuch and lying. They don't take you seriously anymore. Right? Okay. So, children will just think of it. It'll always have temper tantrums for what they want, because we have our own temper tantrums too, and we continue with it until we get what we want, or until we realize that all the temper tantrums in the world is not getting us anywhere. Then it'll stop. So that's a very important point in children. They have to know what's not negotiable right away. You know what I'm saying? It's not negotiable. Sorry. It might be negotiable that you can have a couple of spoons of ice cream an hour before dinner. You know, you're hungry, you just come home from school, you want to have a little snack. But a couple of spoons of ice cream right after you had a Frankfurter is not negotiable, because you're flacious. You following? Maybe I'll buy that cereal that's not so healthy, or I'll buy it, you'll have it Shabbos morning. But I'm not going to buy that cereal because that one's not kosher. And that's not negotiable. But I was at a non-Jewish friend and he had Lucky Charms. I'm sorry, Lucky Charms is not coming into our house. They can know, a three-year-old can already know that. Right? You know, but only of course in a household where kashrus is serious. In a household where they're lax and they sometimes bring in and they sometimes have milk and meat together, the child will see very quickly, oh, hypocrisy is very big. Children can see it right away. Why is this behavior good for me, but it's not good for you? Children know fairness right away. It's not fair. That's very big with kids. And I think they are also, they know justice. A three-year-old knows justice. If that kid grabs a toy and gets to play with it when no one was watching, why can't I grab a toy and play with it? Grab it from someone else. Teacher has to say, okay, I didn't see that. And then the kids start to feel, why is he getting away? I didn't get away with it. And he punched him and no one saw it. He's looking this way. So maybe I should do the same. I'll punch him only when no one's looking. So this is an important element of chinuch. Right? Kids have a profound sense of judgment and justice. It's a very important point to Mishlei of bringing it up in the proper direction. And I think that if there's one other thing, I think kids might have, I'm not sure if it can be taught. The different kids are different. You can have two twins and they're totally different. The DNA is the same. The clothing is the same. The upbringing is the same. Same parents, same food. And yet they go off in very different directions, because we know the chromosomes are different. I'm sorry, in twins, the chromosomes are the same, excuse me. But the circumstances are different. That's the famous argument about nature and nurture, whether it has a greater influence on you, your DNA, your makeup, or your experiences. What do you think Mishlei stresses more?
Experiences.
What you have to do, what you have to experience. Right? We don't take excuses from, well, that's just what I am, what can I do? That there are lots of systems that say that. That's what you are, just be what you are. No, you can. You have the ability to change. Right? We talked about anger. It's quick to anger, slow to anger. We talked about that. So, because that person knew what he is, knew what his weakness is, and he took charge. Okay, Heber, let's read a little bit. We start with Pasuk Aleph. This Mishlei Shlomo ben David Melech Yisrael. He is a king, a son of a king. So he's brought up in great opulence, which is in itself a problem of being spoiled. Right? He's not told like Geber Ki Sa'ol Min Nehurav. He didn't bear a burden in his youth. Right? Paul McCartney, you know who he is, he's in the Beatles. He never had his kids driven around. His kids always had to take the public transportation, not even a taxi. My kids are not going to grow up spoiled. He could afford to buy a fleet of limousines to take them wherever they needed to go. Right? Very crucial, very smart. Right? He himself grew up in poverty. So he says, I can afford anything for my kids, but I just want them to be... Right? Now, if there was a kid, one of his kids killed on a city bus, he would regret that, right? But he said, no, I'm going to play the percentages. Right? More important to me that they grow up as regular kids, right? So a melech ben melech, how is he going to grow up? Think of the paradigm in Tanakh of a spoiled child, born to older parents, an only child usually. They've been looking for him for a long time. Yeah, like Shimshon, Shimshon comes home one day and says, "I want to marry that Philistine woman." His parents say, "Well, not enough Jewish women for you." "No, I want that one." And they get it for him. And they just put their hand down and say, "Sorry, no lucky charms in this house." Right? Problem is that, he was probably indulged. Of course, that was part of God's plan, that Shimshon should wreak havoc upon the Philistines while engaged with Philistine women. Right? It was all part of God's plan. But the plan was,
He was also very strong.
Yeah, so...
He was also indulged.
And amazingly, the Medrash HaGadol says the same about Yitzchak. Remember, he's also... older parents, only child, anticipated for a long time, only child of his mother. I'm sure Sarah spoiled the daylights out of him, right? So what's the function of it? That's why, I wouldn't say this myself, but it's in the Medrash HaGadol. The Bala Turim says it, Daskanim says it. That's how he was bought. He could be bought. And he was bought by food from Yehav Yitzchak and Esav. Why? Kitzayim Deviv. That's a reason to prefer a son, because he puts food in your mouth. Rashi couldn't sustain such a payer, so he gave another one. Kitzayin Befiv. He hunted him with his mouth. You get it? Kitzayin Befiv. Befiv Shal Esav. Not Befiv Shal Yitzchak. You with me? Right? That Yitzchak, Esav, fooled him. That's why he favored him. He'd ask him for tough questions. Okay. Anyway, so the Melech ben Melech might have a problem. His mother's Bathsheba, his father is David. How is this kid going to be raised? L'da'as chochma u'musar l'havin imrei bina. Look at this one pasuk. Da'as chochma and bina. There in one pasuk, your three lower levels of cognitive thinking. All right?
But can you say, just by Shlomo's actions, it doesn't seem to be grounded at all.
So that...
Faith is proverbs or brilliant or whatnot, but...
Right, so we have to be aware of Koheles and Shir HaShirim. Right? He writes Shir HaShirim in youth, the love of youth and the feelings and the stirrings of youth moved him in middle age to write this about Chachma. And then in old age, he wrote Koheles regretting everything else that he had done in the past. Right? He tried to outsmart the Torah and only outsmarted himself. So I know what you're thinking. So why should we bother learning this from someone who didn't take his own advice? Didn't we talk earlier this year about the overweight cardiologist and the married six times therapist? Did I mention that, right? If you chas v'shalom, you're diagnosed with a terrible heart condition, and you're told this cardiologist will take care of everything you need, he's the best in the world, and you're waiting in his office, and you see there's an ashtray filled with butts, there's a liquor cabinet with 40 bottles of scotch, he comes in with a half-eaten pastrami sandwich in his hand, and he looks to be 120 pounds overweight. And you care, you say to yourself, what is he? This guy's a cardiologist. This guy probably has a weak heart himself. He's going to die on the table while doing my open-heart surgery. What's going on here? And you say, what? I don't give two hoots what he does with his own life, as long as he's a magic with the knife in his hand taking care of me. Or a marital therapist who does magic with people with their problems, but he's been married six times himself. He can't apply them to himself. Maybe that's part of his problem. He knows too much. But one thing...
But this is a spiritual.
When it comes to giving mussar, no one wants to hear mussar from an immoral person. Now, it might be that immorality might change with time. You know, most of our philosophical notions are derived from the writings of Socrates, right? They're elementary philosophical notions, and his behavior, by some of our standards, would be outrageous, right? So that maybe that changes over time, but
I feel like even if he
in Greece he was fine. At that time he was fine. How many times in the dialogues does he turn to a 15-year-old boy and say, "Come on, you know where he's gone with him"? This is what they were doing in Greece at the time. Today it's pedophilia and it's putting children in danger right? How about Bertrand Russell, who was caught many times in flagrante with female students? Bertrand Russell was the great philosopher of the 20th century. What was his excuse? Does the plumber take home his tools with him? When the plumber is fixing the plumbing, he's a plumber. When he goes home, he's not a plumber. When I'm in the classroom, when I'm writing books, and I'm a philosopher, in my own private life, you know, don't give me any problems. Really? It's moral to give this girl a higher grade because you're shacking up with her? It's you know, I don't have any patience for this.
So I still don't understand that. Why.
So the question is, let's get back to brass tacks here. Who are you to give me mussar about what kind of advice to take? So let's try to defend him. What's he married to all these women for?
Peace.
He wants to make peace with their fathers. Right?
Well,
did he love them? A king is, all right, take your pleasures like a lion. You know, all right, the king is allowed. But you know, Ramban tells us something beautiful in Parshas Kedoshim. You could be a novel birshu satori. Ever hear of that terminology? Novel birshu satori. You could follow every mitzvah of the Torah and still be a rogue. A rogue meaning you're still a disgusting person. Novel is like a fool, a roguish fool, who is doing everything but with the permission of the Torah. You need good mussar books to get you on the right path. But who are you to give me mussar? You follow me? So we put him on the chopping block and make excuses and explain away some things he did. He acquired too much money, he acquired too many horses, he acquired too many women. Not coincidentally, the things the Torah warns him not to acquire too much. And last week's parsha, right?
But do we know at what point in his life he wrote down these proverbs?
So there's a Gemara in... different opinions, but in Kohelis Rabba it says in middle age.
So you can't say that it was like after all the experiences.
Kohelis is after all those experiences.
Middle age
was what Mishlei said. Mishlei is middle age. Sherman youth. Mishlei middle age. Look, it says he wrote. It says in Tanakh he wrote many books. He wrote 1,005 songs, and he wrote 3,000 proverbs, which is much more than appears in this book, right? So it says in Sefer Melachim. All right, but it's obviously very easy for us to judge, let's just feel the argument I just gave about the cardiologist and the marriage therapist. Why should we bother reading the Mishalim of such a person? All right, maybe that's why Chazal say Chizkiyahu put it together. You know, it needed to be edited because the man who writes a book like this and doesn't live the life has to be. We have to overdo it. Give it the imprimatur of someone else.
But they can't be the standard approach, like because everybody attributes.
And of course, yes.
Yeah.
I'll accept Shir Shirman Kohelis, but I understand your objection to Mishlei. Who are you giving me mussar about chinuch? When you didn't follow the exact three things the Torah said to be careful with. So, right, the Gemara in Sanhedrin in the second parak explains that he thought, well, the Torah says don't have too many wives because they'll turn your heart astray. I'm too smart for that. But they did turn his heart astray. I'll have many horses and I won't go back to Egypt to get them.
Well, so
he did go back to Egypt.
The excuses are the Horas had to go again.
Yeah,
that's
right.
The word.
Okay.
So those just add to the...
I hear you. You know, I mean, I agreed to give this course, which I haven't taught in many years. I looked at it as a challenge. I mean, the question is, who are you to tell me, you know, about Musar? Can you just still say Kabbalah Ebes Mipi Omro? I can learn philosophy from Socrates and Bertrand Russell, right? And I'll, you know, I'll divorce the author from the words. You know, it's interesting, at the end of Sanhedrin, the Gemara talks about kings who have lost their Olam Haba, and then one of the rabbis wanted to include Shlomo. At the end, they said he has too much to teach us. We don't want to have a great author of Tanakh losing his Olam Haba. All right, but here we are. We stuck, you know, we're learning this book, okay? And it is the first and certainly greatest ancient book on this topic. Because no one's interested in morality at the time. They're interested in chinuch. I told you about this Egyptian book, and I'm sure that there are others like it. But to move that into a sense of morality is unique to this book at this time. All right. So it says lokachas musar. Musar has to be acquired, right? Lokachas musar haskel tzedek umishpat. Turn down to the bottom of the page. Umeshorim. Musar Haskel, you've heard of that terminology? And Haskel, Seichel is often termed, we didn't discuss it yet, but often used as like a common sense kind of approach. Right. Okay. And the reason why he mentions Shlomo ben David, why does he have to mention his father's name? Just say the author, Mishle Shlomo, Melech Yisrael. Shir Hashirim doesn't say Ben David.
It does say their last name like that. And it's like instead of, you know.
Try to figure out, why should Shir Hashirim not require Ben David, just Shir Hashirim and Shir Shlomo, right? But Mishle has to be Ben David.
As authority.
Authority, that is tradition from father to son. The Marble points that out. It's a tradition to take from father to son. Okay. Right. As king, he has all the accessible libraries, and he's using information from all places, and that will give you common sense, and a sense of justice, and meisharim, which is the straight path. Before I spoke about justice and compassion, Meisharim, the straight path, requires you to have compassion. L'seis l'psoim arma, l'na'ar da'as umezima. It starts off by saying it'll even give psoim. Psoim is like pesi, machkimas pesi, often termed as fools. But I don't think that's what it means here. Pesi here means like a simpleton. Someone who is very easily influenced. I don't even think that's what the Tam is in the Haggadah. I think the Tam there is a pure child. A pure child is easily molded, perhaps. Right? Orma is a fascinating terminology in Mishle. I want you to get some information about buzzwords in Mishle. It's a buzzword, because outside of Sefer Mishle, Orma is a very negative term. Think about it. What animal is Arum Mikol Ha'adam? Mikol Ha'behemah. The snake. It's Arum. It's called like crafty. Have you heard that terminology? Right? Orma in Mishle is a positive terminology. It means you're crafty in your yira. In your
what?
In your yira, in your faith, in your fear of God. And it gives da'as and mizima to a na'ar. Again, mizima outside of Mishle is a very negative term. If you hear this terminology, lo yibotzer mehem mizima, edim zomamim. Right? It's a negative terminology outside of Mishle. In Mishle it's positive. Where does this word appear? Zamama sadeva tikocheyu mipri chapeha natakare. It's Eishes Chayim. Where is Eishes Chayim? There's Perek in this book. All right? Mizima is something positive. It's amazing. Orma and Mizima have been converted to positive terms in this book. It means making a calculation. Everything you do as a cheshbon. Yishma chacham b'yosef lekach v'navon tachbulos yikna. A chacham is always interested in yosef lekach. Very important. Yosef lekach. He's always adding more information. Everything he does is a learning experience, and he's always adding. Because if you flatline, you're dead. Don't stay flat. Right? Again, tachbulot. Tachbula outside of Mishle is like a planning for nefarious things. Here it's positive. Tachbulot. You see the shorish, chavalah, means violence. Here it's positive. Orma mezima tachbulot. Amazing. Take out the concordance and you see how these three words are used in Yeshayahu, in Yirmiyahu, in Yechezkel. Very negative. In Eov, Eov uses these words a lot. They appear in the Torah. And here it's given a positive bent. Do you see what Mishlei is doing? Every term, every personality can be bent to the positive. Plan, also like Orma, planning, like Edim Zomimim. Why are false witnesses called Edim Zomimim? Because they had to plan together. They had to. All right. And when they ask you what, because they interrogate the witnesses separately, you have to make sure that you zomim your words. You following that? To make sure that you zomim your plan together. Here in Mishlei, it's make sure that you plan out your life. Don't just let things happen to you. Life needs a plan.
What's
Tachbula? Tachbula is also a plan. A council. But outside of Mishlei, it's the Shorish is Chabalah. Right? What are Mechablim in modern Hebrew? Terrorists. Because terrorists have, they plan out terror. They plan out. You see it? Lahavin mashal umalitza divrei chachamim v'chidosam yiras Hashem reishis da'as chochma umusar evilim bazu. So some say that the introduction ends with pasuk Zion. Some say it ends with pasuk Vav. I prefer Zion. I think it ends with pasuk Zion. He says that there's a mashal umalitza. There are different types of proverbs. Okay, one that requires like a parable, that's more like a malitza. A mashal usually has to be easily remembered. That makes it more valuable. It can be brought back by people. Right? Okay, but I'm telling you right now, while this is your reishis das, is the first thing you should know, is morality. But fools, evilim, they despise it. Why does a fool despise morality? Don't tell me what to do. I want to do what I feel. Many therapists will tell you that also. I want to do what feels good. I'm not going to be told what to do. Right? Okay, so what did we do today? We did the introduction to Mishlei with the first three levels of cognitive thinking. Right? And the injection of morality into the system, which is unique to the Jewish system, okay?